This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Muslim Chaplaincy Conversation at ORFM Dunedin.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. In the name of God, most gracious, most merciful. Assalamu alaikum, which means peace be with you in Arabic. My name is Arina Aizal and I'll be your host for the Muslim Chaplaincy Conversation today. In today's episode, we continue our interview with Sister Al-Khansa Al-Bashir. Originally from Sudan, a PhD student at the Department of Chemistry, University of Otago, and an environmental engineer at a firm in Qatar. As usual, though, we begin with a recitation of the Quran by Sheikh Mishari Al-Fash, Surah 14, Ibrahim, verses 42-46.
ولا تحسبن الله غافلا عما يعمل الظالمون إنما يؤخرهم ليوم تشخص فيه الأبصار مهطعين مقنعي رؤوسهم لا يرتد إليهم طرفهم وأفئدتهم هواء وأنذر الناس يوم يأتيهم العذاب فيقول الذين ظلموا ربنا أولم تكونوا أقسمتم من قبل ما لكم من زوال وسكنتم في مساكن الذين ظلموا أنفسهم وتبين لكم كيف فعلنا بهم وضربنا لكم الأمثال وقد مكروا مكرهم وعند الله مكرهم وإن كان مكرهم لتزول منه الجبال.
Translation of the recited verses. In the name of God, most gracious, most merciful. Do not think that God is unaware of what the wrongdoers and oppressors do. He only gives them respite until a day when their eyes will stare in terror. They will rush forward, craning their necks, unable to divert their eyes, a gaping void in their hearts. So warn people of the day when punishment will come to them, and when those who did wrong will say, Our Lord, give us a little more time. We shall answer your call and follow the messengers. Why were you not the ones who used to swear in the past that your power would not have end? You lived in the same places as others who wronged themselves before, and you were clearly shown how we dealt with them. We gave you many examples. They made their plots, but even if their plots had been able to move mountains, God had the answer. We will now have our interview with Sister Khansa. Assalamu alaikum, Sister Khansa.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Thanks for being here again. Last time we talked about you growing up in Sudan and Qatar, your studies and work, your study tours to other countries. Yep. And we also talked about you coming to New Zealand and your first impressions here. Mm-hmm. This interview will focus on the situation in Sudan, to which you had a reference at the end of your last interview. But before that, do you want to tell us about the Muslim community in Dunedin? If you could share your views on the mosque and their activities.
Yeah. So I, as I mentioned last time, I started going to the masjid as when I arrived to New Zealand. And as struggles increase and so on, I start to work more or like go to more toward the masjid. And the first thing that I met in the masjid, the first people, group of people that I met in the masjid were Musa Club, the girls from the Musa Club. I don't know if you know them, Hajar and Amana and Maryam, and so these girls. And they were trying to do a lot of activities, or at least these are the activities that I saw as someone who came from outside. These are the activities that I saw. Other than some figures in the community, some women in the community, they were also like helpful and so on. So the masjid in general has a lot of activities, or some activities that target like the elder group in the community. However, and that's a really good, like, there's a lot of like effort going on there, and the masjid is trying a lot to help the youth into to do their things. But at the same time, the other side of the masjid that I noticed, and which now is like being resolved kind of, is that we noticed that there is a gap between the masjid community and the families around the masjid, like most of the families, the Muslim families around the masjid, and especially the youth and the young people, which I think that they should be the most focus for the Muslim, for the masjid, as it's the main place for the Muslims and so on. And recently we noticed that there is a lot of issues in the community that need to be looked at. And thankfully, you know, like when you like keep talking about something, itself is actually like, could, even if you are like, because I'm busy with my PhD, most of the time I can't be on the, like, doing the action. But sometimes when you just keep talking about the issues, when you say that these are the issues, you know, like we are Muslims and we believe that kuntum khayra ummatin ukhrijat linnas ta'muruna bil ma'ruf wa tanhauna 'anil munkar. So like the main basis in our Islamic religion is that you have to tell people when they are doing something wrong, to tell them not to do it. And if they are doing something, and you should tell them as well to do something good. So sometimes just speaking could do change. And recently, the Musa girls, who, like, they are not part of Musa now, but they are actually doing another group of work that they want to do, like an organization to try to do things in the masjid. And also there is a new organization called Nisa. They are also, which is translated to women, they are also trying to do things in the community to help changes. And all of this, I think, is just because you kept saying, please do changes, you need changes, you need to do changes, there is something wrong. And you point out these things, and then people start to move toward these changes. And I hope, actually, with time, people will be able to be helpful. And, you know, like, more people will be going toward the masjid and so on.
What sorts of activities does the Nisa and women organize?
So they are trying to do activities that, like, have, like, it's like religious activities, but at the same time, it involves the community. So being the community toward the masjid. So they try to do gatherings. And now, for example, they did some, like, an iftar activity. So, like, fun activities, but when you go there, you find that it's like combination of community things as well as like governed by religious values.
Do you have any voluntary work with the Muslim community?
So other than the work that I mentioned last time at the school as teaching, as I told you, I try to be like in the meetings and so on, and like point things out and these things. And also we started Quran classes around Dunedin, because I feel like as a Muslim, if you want to build the values in someone, you should teach them Quran, and this is the main thing. So that's why we started Quran classes around Dunedin. We have, I think like around 7 or 8 classes, and we have also a lot of teachers that are involved. And this is all actually because as well, there was like a Qari program, which is a program that teach how to teach Quran, that run around New Zealand. And from there, we had like many graduates from that program, plus some students who came from Arabic countries and they know Quran well. So like combination of these teachers, we started the classes of Quran. And in the classes of Quran, we do fix the Arabic way of saying, reading the Quran, memorizing the Quran, and also understanding the Quran. So it's like combination of all of that.
It's good to know that there are Quran teachers around Dunedin now.
Yes, yeah. So we didn't have this before. Like, it wasn't there. And now that we have it in that big, or we're trying to make it, like, as big as we can to cover, like, a lot of people, that's actually a good initiative. Yeah.
Let's talk about the situation in Sudan. Can you please give our listeners a short overview of Sudan, talking about its geographical location, natural resources, and also the demographic composition?
So Sudan is a country that is in the north of Africa. It's an Arabic African country. It's below Egypt and next to Libya and Tchad from the west. And in the east, it has an opening to the Red Sea and then Eritrea below that. And that opening actually give Sudan a lot of interest in terms of its geographic location and strategic location as well. And also it has the River Nile, which developed a lot of agriculture importance and so on. So these two things put Sudan in a very in the eyes of other countries through its history since early ages. And also it has a lot of resources. Sudan is one of the highest exports of the Arabic gum, which is important for a lot of industrial things. And also it has a lot of gold mines, and when you hear gold mines, again, a lot of interest and so on. And also it has the it has oil reserves, but they were in the south of Sudan, which now is not part of Sudan, and this is part of the issues that we'll talk about in next. And also it has some uranium deposit. No one touched them yet, but they are also in the west of Sudan, and again, it's also part of the conflict that is happening now. So, as I said, it has a lot of natural resources that led to a lot of interest from many countries.
Can you tell us about the historical and political background of Sudan and how the modern Sudanese state has developed?
Yes. So I will focus on the period that connects to the conflict. So Sudan was colonized by the British Empire till 1956. And looking at the 30s and the 40s, when the people were trying to fight against the British colonization, it tells you from where the Sudanese street got the spirit of the identity and the how they are connected to their country and the want of the choice to select what they want. So in that time there was someone called Al Mahdi. He was the revolutionist. He led the revolution against the British Empire. And in 1956, it was when the Sudan got their independence. And from that time till 1989, there was a lot of different military governments followed by civilian government, then military corps, and then again civilian government and so on. And this all was happening because of the conflict between the between the different parties in Sudan. There was the Islamic parties and then the Shiuai party. I don't know if that's the English word of it. So the Ishtiraki, I forgot the name, but different types of parties, they were in conflict to rule the Sudan. And what was happening is, so you start with the civilian government. And then because the colonizer, when they were there, and that's part of the British ideology, is that they try to break the Sudan into, in any countries that they were in, they try to break the different tribes. They find something and then they divide people on it. So when they leave, you have the unstable state or a reason for conflict to happen. That was happening. So all of that period, it was this instability because there was a failure to solve the issue of the south. So south of Sudan has a lot of like a different construction of people. Like they are mostly Africans, while the north is mostly Arab tribes. So this was the reason for the conflict. They felt always that they were not given their rights through the colonization as well. The north was well developed while they ignored the south. And there was always the feeling of that the north people are better than the south people. And that was part of the issue. So when the independence happened, all the government that came before, they had a failure into solving that issue, the south issue. And it continued till currently. And then that kept happening, like from civilians to then the military civilians, without going onto the details of which group they were. Through that, the Islamic Revolution, the Islamic Party, led by Dr. Al-Turabi, rahimahullah, they were trying to get the rule. They were doing a lot of background things to like get into the rule. And all the coups that were happening were actually politically led by one of the parties. Like one of the parties tell the government, the military to cope of the civilian government and so on. So in 1989, military governed by, led by, it's not, it wasn't governed by, but it was led by Al-Turabi and the Islamic Party. They coped over the civilian government that was there, and they called it the Hukumat al-Inqaz, like the name of it literally means the government that came to save people from what was happening, because actually there was a lot of issues with that government. Like the condition was really bad. There was a lot of poverty and so on. So that's why they said, okay, now we want to save the people from all of that. And the South issue was like even like bigger and bigger. And this was the start of the government, the al-Bashir government, that continued for like 30 years from 1989 till 2019.
So Omar al-Bashir and his political party ruled Sudan for 20 years, from the late 1989 to the late 2019. Yes. Can you tell us more about that government, how it ruled, how it ended, and also whether it was viewed negatively by Sudanese people?
So that government, as I told you, at the beginning it started with the party, like the Islamic Party, pushing the military to do the coups to the civilian government. And the thing was, the idea when it started was good, because the idea was that the military will be in the lead, but there will be a parliament. And the parliament has civilian parties governing it, led by Al-Turabi. And that was the good thing. But then, because the military were like, no, we don't want any civilian, and we want to rule everything. So they actually detained Al-Turabi himself, and they break the parliament. So now it's completely military government. And that was the first mistake that the government filled in. Because after that, it was just a military government. And so they started to silence all other parties. And that is another mistake that they did as well. Because that just like made a lot of opposite parties to like try to destabilize the condition, instead of everyone trying to actually fix fix the government and everything. But to be fair as well, at the beginning of the government, things were going well, and Sudan, like through that time, they were actually like doing a lot of efforts for the the surrounding region as well, the Arabic and Muslim region. And Hukumat al-Bashir, the al-Bashir government, was part of that. They were supportive for the Islamic movement. They were supportive of the Arabic governments and so on. However, again, comes the South problem. So al-Bashir tried to fix that. Like, he did a lot of efforts with other governments from Gulf region and Libya and so on to solve the issue of the South, and also African countries. And till 2010, things were fine, or 2009, around that time. And I was in Sudan at that time. So at that time, al-Bashir was able to find a solution for the South issue. with the lead of the government in the south. His name is Jongeren. And when they signed an agreement to solve the issue of the south and everything was fine, so like Jongeren died in a plane. They bombed the plane and Jongeren died. So this kind of killed the hopes for the agreement. And I remember I was in Sudan. I remembered all the South Sudanese people going in the street. It was so scary. They were going the street. They were like doing movements and so on for their lead, their ruler, which is Jongeren. And after that, because of the escalation, they were like, okay, we will give you the right to decide what you want. And this is when the Sudan was separated. The north of Sudan was separated from south of Sudan. And that was the beginning of the south of Sudan. And I remember our neighbor, she was from south of Sudan. She was like, I will leave. Khalas, bye. I'm going back to my country and we will start a new country and everything. And this was actually, again, because of U.S. Because the U.S. was giving them the hope that we will give you your land and all of this and that. And that's because the oil is in South Sudan. It's not because actually they wanted to give people freedom or anything. I remember this. She went back to South Sudan. Few months later, most of them came back. Because, again, if you want to actually take the oil from someone, make the country unstable. And that will happen in South Sudan. So they had the hope that when they go back, with the help of U.S., they will be able to build their country. But that's not the case because U.S. won the oil. So they will keep destabilized. And the destabilization continued, and unfortunately, I hope that actually they had the ability to make their country. But these hopes never, like, they're just like, you know, like, just dreams that U.S. put in the heads of people to for their own benefit. And they came back. She came back. She still lived, like, next to our house. And then another point where the government did a mistake was when they tried to solve the problem of the West, which is Darfur. So because Darfur had a lot of tribes, Arabic and non-Arabic tribes or mixed tribes and so on, they had their own conflicts as tribes. It has nothing to do with the government. They had their own issues. So Omar al-Bashir, in order to try to fix that, what he did, he went to one of the tribes, their name is Rizegan, and they told them, fight for me. And this is the beginning of the entity, which is called the Rabid Force, the Rabid Force, which is now part, one side of the conflict. So Omar al-Bashir was like, okay, we'll create that Rabid Force, and they will fight for us in the West. They will fight against these tribes. And I feel like that was the biggest mistake that Omar al-Bashir did, because other than looking at it like from like the historical line only, when you do something like that, when you, like, even us as Sudanese, we were like living at that time. I was in Sudan at that time, knowing that there is an entity like that that is making, like, that is killing people, actually, in the West. We were silent about it at that time. We didn't, like, I don't remember that much that we were, like going the street asking for the break of that entity. And that entity as well, like the Rabid Force group, they were also fighting in the Yemen against our brothers and sisters in the Yemen, against the Houthi, with support of some of the governments in the Gulf region who are now supporting the conflict. Like, they are trying to, like, they are giving, like, they are part of the conflict that is going now in Sudan. So I'm just, like, seeing the irony. Like, while we were, like, not actually doing anything against these people, at some point they came and they did this to us as well. So I feel like this has always happened in the history, and this is one of the Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, like, how when you see the, you know, the bad things are happening and you just close your eyes, it will happen to you as well. So his government was good till at the end of it. After 2011, all of these things were happening. And also, at some point, it was just continuous of, like, corruption. And I remember they closed, hospitals and, like, government hospitals that they were free for people. They closed this government. There were a lot of corruption happening. I remember I was, like, in the plane with one of the while I was going back to Qatar just for a trip, and I was in the plane next to the head of one of the governmental hospital. And he told me that I just by luck, I sat next to him, and I just usually talk to people in the plane. He told me that he was going out of Sudan because he was the head of that educational hospital. It was free, and there was a lot of corruption. But he was trying to like satisfy these people who want to take the money of people. But at the same time, he was little by little trying to do the things for people as well, like buying some of the equipment that they need, do this and that. But he said that even that was not allowed. Like even that, they tried to like make things tight on him. And then he felt like, why am I doing this? I'm part of the issue. Like people later will be like, that person who was in the head of the hospital was part of the corruption, and I can't do this. And he left. And as I said, that's what also was one of the reasons that my dad as well left Sudan, because at some point he was like, I can't be part of this. I just have to leave. So all of this poverty, a lot of things were actually really going bad in Sudan. And that like make the people want the change, want the people to do revolution against that government. But also in the background, other than that, and other than other parties who actually wanted to like just be in the role, there were a lot of youth people, especially that Sudan has a lot of the Sudanese youth use Facebook a lot. At that time, a lot of youth people were invited from countries in the Gulf region, which are part of the conflict as well, to give them development classes. And these development classes actually were just to change their ideology, their thinking. So at that time, at the end of al-Bashir government, there was a lot of youth people. They were speaking in a language that was never before in Sudan. They were speaking in a language of changes and this and that. And you can actually see that these people actually are fed of information that or of beliefs that were never in the street. And then you think, where are they from? And then you go back and you see that, oh, these are the people who at some point went to these classes and these courses and so on and so on.
What sorts of ideologies was it?
When you hear it, you will think that it's a good ideologies, which is like, we want freedom. We want to our own right to think about ourselves. But then you ask them, how are you planning to do that? What are you going to do? What is the thing that you, how do you want that? And then they don't have an answer. You just feel that these people are just thinking of destroying what is already built without thinking of how to build the good thing. You know, like they didn't have that part of the answer. So they were just fed information that would lead them to cause destabilization, but without thinking of, okay, what is the answer after that? So they didn't have that answer. They just wanted to break the current government. And all of that combined, I'm not saying that the government also was a good thing to start with. All of that leads to the revolution after that.
So there were a lot of hope for a democratic Sudan after the 2019 revolution and the end of al-Bashir's government. But unfortunately, we got the brutal war that's still going on. Can you tell us the root causes of the war after that?
So what happened in 2019, I remember I was in Qatar. I was driving next to the museum. And when Omar al-Bashir was still in the rule and in the end of his, in the Independence Day, which is 25th of December, there is a party that they do. And it's they show it in the national TV, and everyone was watching that party. I remember my father was next to me, and everyone thought that Omar al-Bashir at that point will come out and will pass the government to someone else, because if he didn't do that, that means like a complete destroy of the whole government, which is actually destroying something is very easy, but building it back is very difficult. So everyone was thinking that Omar al-Bashir would do that, but he didn't. He didn't. Like, it was just a normal party. All of us were just watching the TV, waiting for that moment to happen. Nothing happened. The chorale sang everything, and that's it. Nothing happened. And my dad told me he won't stay. Next year will be revolution, definitely. And that actually happened. So what happened is people went to the street for revolution, for asking Omar al-Bashir to, like, step out of the government, and it happened. They took Omar Bashir out, and they had a transitioning government. So the transitioning government was led by the head of the military, which is Al-Burhan, and then part of the military is the Rabid Force, governed by Hemeti. So the transitioning government at the beginning was, it also had the, like it was 50-50 with the military and the civilian parties. The civilian parties, they are called Qahat, so the Quwa al-Hurriya wa al-Taghir, so the Quwa al-Hurriya wa al-Taghir. So they are like the strength of like the change, and these are the people that I told you are a kind of these people, but they had help of other parties as well. So anyway, it was like 50 military or like military, and it also has civilians entities in that transitioning government. But when we say transitioning government, they shouldn't have the right to make actual changes in the country, right? They are just there to transition the government from one, like from like to someone to start the change, to start the new country and so on. But that government wasn't doing that actually. What they were doing, which actually made the situation worse, they were making very brutal decisions. They started a contract with Israel, and which I think in the interview we may talk about it later, but they started the relations with Israel in 2020. And this was the first time in the history of Sudan that the country has an agreement with Israel. And not that only, they also focused on unnecessary things at that time. They tried to change the education system, to take the Quran out of the education system, which people were like, why are you doing that? While actually you should focus on creating a political stability. With all of that happening and all of these things happening, the military were like, okay, we'll do a coup, as was happening in the Sudanese history. So the military take role, and it was, as I told you, Al-Burhan and the Rabid Force were below them, under the military forces. And that went for a while, and then the Rabid Forces were like, we want the rule. And this was the beginning of the conflict. So they were like, we don't want Al-Burhan, and we want to rule the whole situation. So when you look at it from outside, you think that it's just a conflict between the, again, from different parties, and it's a conflict from between the military and between the rebel forces, but it's actually, it's not. It's other governments supporting that, like one of the sides, for their own interests, and that like how the conflict like kept increasing.
So how has the conflict developed since 15th of April 2023?
So the first attack was, as you mentioned, during April, and it's just they started like bombing the capital city, which is Al Khartoum, and then they started spreading to other areas. And the military was actually in a very weak situation already. The whole country was in a weak situation and a very fragile condition at that time. So that helped them to be able to like take more of the control of more of a lot of areas. And when I tell you about the Rabid Force, we call it force, right? Like you think that it's a military entity. But actually they were not. They were like group of people. Like they didn't had like an organized military training. They didn't had like what any like military entity has, like an organization and like 1, 2, 3, like the levels and so on. They didn't have that. It's just group of people that are fighting. They weren't educated. They didn't have any moral standard to look back to. So when you give power to these people, when you give money to these people, and keep in mind that the Rabid Force had the role of all the oil mines. So that means if they are, and this is before that, like if they are controlling all the oil mines, then if you get control of that people, you can get your hand into the oil mines. Sorry, the gold mines. So they were like an immoral group that just kept spreading everywhere, attacking people, killing people, and so on and so on. And the military wasn't, as I told you, wasn't that, they didn't have that much of power. So it just kept happening between both of them.
And how does the external or regional actors influence the conflict?
So, as I told you, a lot of countries had interest in Sudan, and the rebel force were supported by countries in Gulf region, mostly the UAE, which now is a fact, actually, like it's mentioned in UN and a lot of places, that the UAE is support to the rebel forces, and the biggest proof of that. UAE doesn't have any gold mines, and in 2024, UAE had doubled or tripled their gold reserve from nowhere. So where is that from? It's from Sudan. It's the gold mines in Sudan. So they were supporting that thing. And as I told you again, they were also, from the beginning, before the Omar al-Bashir was taken, they were already trying to put their ideas, or the ideas in the youth minds to like create that instability. And also US is part of that as well, because they were also trying to like put the put Darfur in that instability as well, because of the uranium areas in Darfur and so on. So each group were supporting one of the two sides, like UAE was supporting Hemeti, and they also found like a lot of passport from foreign countries like France and this and that. There are a lot of countries, Chad. There were a lot of countries that were trying to like put their hands in Sudan, and they were supporting that the rebel force group, regardless of the bad things that they were doing to the people of Sudan. And the military is not also like completely innocent in that as well. They were also taking support from other countries for, it could be at some point for their own benefit. They want to rule Sudan, but most of the people will tell you that's also because, and I believe that as well, that they were trying to free Sudan from the rebel force group, and they are the actual official force that should be fighting for the Sudanese or defending the Sudanese people. And this is how it like kept developing until now. Currently a lot of cities were freed, but other cities are still under the rebel force. And recently, like just before yesterday, the rebel force attacked the east side of Sudan, which was under the military. And the thing is, whenever the rebel force find that things are getting better, military are taking back things, and Sudanese people are going back to their life, they start attacking the water stations. They attack the electrical station. They attack the things that are necessities for people's life. And they attacked that city, which was actually a very stable city. It was away from everything. When they found that military are like winning in the west, they were like, okay, let's go to the east because the military is there. Let's go to the east and create the stability again.
So how does the effect of war affect the ordinary Sudanese?
So a lot of people were displaced, and currently Sudan is one of the biggest Sudanese people were one of the biggest people. They were displaced in history. Like millions were displaced from Sudan, including my family, and a lot of those who were able to move outside of Sudan, they were displaced. They are just like in Tashhad, in Egypt, in many other countries. Those who were able to like go to some countries because they had like the capability of like work and so on, they were able to go and work somewhere. But most of the people were just displaced. They are just like refugees somewhere currently. And those who weren't able, they didn't have the ability to go out to Sudan, are living in a very bad starvation and poverty in Sudan. Although some of them, including my village, like they are actually rich. They have their farms. They have their gold. Actually, they really have like enough gold. So they are not They weren't poor. They were in really good condition. It just accepting to live in village. That's the thing. But when the rabbit force came, they took over the farms. They kicked people out of their farms. They stole all of their gold and everything. They stole their cars, everything. They just left them with nothing other than the massive killing. So it's like kind of a genocide. They just go to a village. They kill everyone without like separating woman, man, child. They don't look actually at that. And other than that, the sexual abuse. So if you want to know that this group has no molar, see how they act with women. So there was a lot of sexual abuse happened to Sudanese women. And it's just very scary because, like, when you think of, like, or when you hear that the rebel forces are going to some village or something, you think of the women in there, what will happen to them? You know, and there was a lot of stories of women talking about how they abused them and how they killed them, and sometimes in front of their families, like, and then they kill the whole family. So they do this, and after that, they as well, like, kill the family and so on. So this so that affect the Sudanese people a lot, and it's just like the trauma of them. Even for me, who wasn't living there, just calling my family sometimes and hearing the bomb, I still feel that I have effects from that situation. So imagine the people who are actually living there, and the national like the UN and these things and the national war, the whole world is not that kind to people when they are actually suffering. So you know that, like, instead of easing things for them, they make things harder. They don't give them visa. I remember when I was coming to New Zealand, my visa took 6 months because I just couldn't get a paper from the government of Sudan because they weren't government. And I was trying to explain this to the to people here that I actually can't get that paper. I don't have a government to get that paper. At the end, with the help of Qatar government, I was able to, like, they helped me a lot. And also the Sudanese embassy there, I was able to, like, come here, and they were like, and like they provided me with a lot of proofs of my identity and so on and so on. So imagine other people who were in Sudan who were trying to, like, refugees and so on. And I wish that actually there were, like, more help for people in Sudan to be able to, like, move to other countries. They are more like, they make their life easier to move on and live a better life.
Do you see any realistic hope for peace or resolution in the near future?
It's a bit hard to like give like a solid answer for that part, because as I told you, as long as the external entities are trying to, like, interfere in the condition in Sudan, that war will just keep igniting. But again, to be positive, to tease at the positive side, the as I told you, the military is getting their hand on some of the parts, and I feel like a lot of Sudanese as well in the street are doing a lot of movements to fix the streets, to fix the things, and to rebuild the schools and so on. And I feel, and I believe that the Sudanese like will for like for live, like their positive spirit and so on will again bring back life to Sudan. But currently, the only thing that we can do is, like, pray. Support the people in Sudan, support them by, like, giving them chances to, like, for, like, scholarships and visas, and open the hand for them, because most of them are actually well-educated and so on.
I'm sure, like most other Muslims and many non-Muslims, you are concerned about what's going on in Palestine. How much did you know about the Palestinian issue before the recent Gaza genocide?
So the Palestinian cause is related to me and, like, to Muslims in their belief, because the Palestinians are Muslims as well, and also as for me as an Arab, and I was grown with a lot of like movements that were trying to support Palestine. I was born in 1997, and that was like when a lot of Arabic countries were trying to, like, do something for Palestine, and then we learned a lot in the school as well about the Nakba, the first Nakba and the second Nakba and all of that. Because, as I told you, Palestine is part of my identity. I'm not Palestinian, but it's part of my identity. And I remember one of my colleagues asked me, why are you talking about Palestine? Because when I came here, 1 month after I came here was the beginning of the, like, was the 7th of October condition, like, it happened at that time. And he was like, why are you focusing too much in Gaza? Like, it's not your, you should be focusing on Sudan, like the war in Sudan. I was like, it's never different. It's the same thing. The same enemy, the same thing. And even if it's the same enemy, they are, like, Muslims. They are Arabs. They are my people as well. That's why I'm focusing on them.
Sudan also played a historical role to support Palestine during the 1967 Arab League summit in Khartoum. Can you tell us about that meeting?
So that was the that was after the defeat that the Arab had against Israel in 1967, and the Arabs were thinking of having a meeting for all Arabs countries, enabled to like in order to like. Revolve or get back the strength back for the countries that were affected by the war, namely Egypt and Jordan, because they were the first line against Israel. And also they were trying to like solve the conflict between the Arab entities themselves, especially the strength, the one that has the like the oil resorts, like Libya at that time was a strong country, and Saudi Arabia and so on. And in that meeting, a very important thing happened, which was the three no's policy. And the three no's policy is actually the no peace with Israel, no recognition of Israel, no negotiations with Israel. So all the Arabic countries agreed to that, these three policies. And that was the main outcome of that meeting. And from that, it started the Arabic group at that meeting. And that was also connected to the conditions of Sudan and why Sudan had a lot of like they had a lot of issues with the US and a lot of siege from US, and that was why Sudan actually had a lot of poverty and so on. It's because Sudan had a very solid state in the Gaza, in the Palestinian cause, starting from three no's. And the irony is, in 2020, when I told you they had the first agreement with Israel, they did it in the same location where they did the three no's policy. So you can see that actually it's not like just like random things. These people were, from that time, they were thinking, we will go back there and we will do our agreement in that specific place. And that actually the saddest, like it's a very sad thing when you look at it. And but talking about that specific meeting, from there were a lot of hopes for that. But again, like the Arab condition, everyone is thinking of their own, their own role, their own benefit and so on. Some of the entities went out of that agreement, even behind or below the table, as they say. So not everyone actually were doing the no peace with Israel, no recognition of Israel, no negotiation with Israel. A lot of entities, Arabic entities, started the negotiation with Israel and started the conflicts with other entities that completely refused, like Libya, for example, refused any negotiation with Israel, because it's like it's against Palestinian people, and also because it is, and till now, it's a threat to the whole stability of the whole region. And they saw that, and they were talking about that. But as you, things were just like, they till now, a lot of, our currently, many Arab countries, like, very clearly, they have relation with, unfortunately, with Israel.
So, sadly, the genocide in Gaza and Palestine now has been overshadowed by the new murderous campaign by Netanyahu and Trump. Do you have any comments on the war on Iran?
US, whenever they say we are bringing peace to some place, run from that location, because they are not bringing peace to any place. And in Sudan, it happened like that, the similar condition that happened in Iran. Remember, like before a few months in Iran, when they said that they want to, US want to come and they want to do the peace in, and they want to give Iranian the right to decide and so on. It happened in Sudan as well. And similar to what happened in Iran, in Sudan as well, people refused to do anything with U.S. because they knew even if the government is bad, U.S. is not the solution. And Iranians had the same, most of them, most of Iranians had the same belief that U.S. is not the solution, even if the government is bad. And that actually was a good thing. But will U.S. stop in there? No. They still want to create destability. And they have a lot of things. They start first to destabilize the people. If it didn't work, they will start to make destabilization around that country, which is happening now. Like a lot of Gulf region are involved in that situation from the military bases that they had. And you may ask me why they have these military bases. It's again U.S. Like ideologies and thinking. And like, so currently, just like to talk about the Iran condition. It's like my family is in Qatar, and some people say that Iran is not attacking the countries; they are attacking the U.S. bases. And then, but actually, people are getting harmed from that. Like people in Qatar, in UAE, in Kuwait, and all of these countries, they are getting harmed from that. So, what is the solution? Will they attack back Iran? But if they attack back Iran, Iran will attack them, and that all of that will just like make these countries more fragile. And then when U.S. will come and be like, I will save this condition, similar to what happened in Iraq, in Libya, and in Vietnam, and many, many examples. So does Trump and Netanyahu want peace for anyone? No. They want their own benefit. And we know that as they got the oil from Venezuela, they are fine. So the fact that a lot of countries are affecting from the oil, they don't care about it because they have their own oil reserves currently. So they are fine in that situation. So they don't care about anyone, like not Europe, not any place around the world. Like if the whole world is like in a complete starvation or a complete issue, or they're out of light because of the oil problems, they don't care because they have their own benefits and their own reserves and so on.
Thank you so much, Sister Hansa, for the second interview we have with you today. Do you have any final words to share to our listeners?
I just want people to like think beyond what they see in like in the news and the propaganda that like like identities like US and so on they say, and actually read and go ask people, like just ask people. And thankfully, we have the social media currently, so you can just go and check from the people. You can read what is happening in Gaza. You can read what's happening in Palestine, and we have like we have a say in Arabic, which is translate to knowing about history will add age to your age. So knowing about the history and going to read from all the sides, even if you are a Muslim, for example, go listen to other people like from US, because it could also tell you why are they doing this? Why are like the US, for example, American, are accepting this? And then you will figure out that they all also under that propaganda. And then you can find that back by talking to them and be like, what you know is wrong. So reading more, looking behind the screen, looking behind what everyone is talking is what I actually will ask everyone, like Muslim, Arab, non-Arab, non-Muslim, everyone to do, because it's all for your human being, for like for your human friend, for the person, the people around you. And it will affect you. If today it wasn't your issue, like what happened for us, like rabbit forces, it was happening next to us. As Sudanese, we were seeing it and we were not doing anything. If it wasn't, it's not happening to us now, it will happen to us at some point if we accept that happening. So that's why I ask everyone to please like go read, ask, care about others, because it's not about politics. Don't listen to that thing when they tell you, you have nothing to do with politics. Everyone has to do with politics because it will affect you. So you have to be educated. You have to know what is happening around you.
Jazakallah khair. Thank you so much, sister. Now, we listen to a song, Against Aggression, by the American folk singer Seth Staten Watkins, entitled The Nation That You Love.
Well, the star-spangled flags were playing loose with a mag across continents, countries, and years. Since before it was, it's been shooting cause it must spread its noble ideas. So you can clutch your pearls and pray to God, but I think it's about time that you know that the violent imperial boomerang will always come home. So cry for the innocent and condemn the violent ones, but turn that condemnation round on the nation that you love. So cry for the innocent and condemn the violent ones. But turn that condemnation round on the nation that you love. Ask the Native Americans or Indonesians or Rockies or the Vietnamese. If the Star-Spangled Banner ceases violent endeavors to respect their humanity, it's not political violence if it's covert alliances with Contras and a Mujahideen. No, you can fund a genocide of Palestinians with no accountability. So cry for the innocent and condemn the violent ones, but turn that condemnation round on the nation that you love. So cry for the innocent.
That is the end of our program today. Thank you for your time. Special thank you to Otago Access Radio for facilitating the production of this program. I should add that the views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily represent the views of Otago Muslim Chaplaincy as such. If you have any questions, please email muslimchaplaincy@otago.ac.nz. We hope to see you next time, inshallah, God willing. Assalamu alaikum. You've been listening to Muslim Chaplaincy Conversation at OARFM Dunedin.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.